It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. So have you been slapping any Calvinists?
I have, yes.
That was the title you wanted.
Yes, yes. I didn't get any email yet, so either it hasn't aired or it's not a big deal.
Or you're not checking your email.
Oh, that's true. I declare email bankruptcy quite
also
often.
Also, a lot of comment on the blog. No one seems horribly offended. This is only a day after it aired, so people are saying there might be a big brouhaha brewing earlier in the week we don't know about yet. But
what is a brouhaha?
For a lot of ha-has are brewing. I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay.
But
yes, I slapped four Calvinists in Albertsons on the ketchup aisle.
Oh, what were they doing in the ketchup aisle? Was that predestined?
I think so.
I thought you'd have found them among the tulips, not among the tulips.
No, okay. No, just the ketchup aisle.
Well, we'll talk. If we need to talk about that more, we'll do that later. We've got someone with us today.
A guest.
Joined us from...
A guest. She's smiling.
Austin, Texas. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Wayne. Hi, Brad.
Oh, thank you. I was going to say, me too.
She got you in there. Don't worry about it.
Just sorry.
I met Renee a couple of months. I met you almost 6 months ago in Texas, in Dallas, at a house church conference.
That's right.
And she's got a little thing she does in Austin called Jib.
Jib?
Jesus ice cream and beer. It's a way it's a way they get together.
Ever heard of church called Jib?
Yeah, she's not much on the beer part of it. She says she's really into the Jesus and the ice cream. And
I know with ice cream and root beer, it really does make that little frothy part. I've never even considered it with beer.
Yeah.
Does it make a really frothy, creamy head? What's the deal?
We've tried a couple of combinations, but really it's best to keep those separate.
No? Yeah.
Yeah.
Even the Jesus from the ice cream. Because all that great with ice cream all over.
Jesus and ice cream go together. That's how you get them to Sunday school.
Okay.
No? You never did that?
I haven't tried to
get
to Sunday school in a long
forever,
time.
Dude.
Yeah.
Ice cream's in tight with heaven.
It's really just the way our group came together.
Jesus ice cream. Now, that's a good teaser. How did Jesus ice cream and beer bring a group together?
Well, we just came together for some conversation and some extended time of worship, and somebody brought the ice cream and somebody brought the beer, and we all brought a little bit of Jesus with us.
And so they decided that they wanted to call it something. They call it Jib.
Jib.
Jesus ice cream and beer.
Hey, dude,
and,
Jib.
So it's a pretty active community of folks in the Austin area. Mostly, you said, like 30s and 40s?
Largely, yeah. Largely 30s
Austin's
and 40s.
Austin's a pretty hit music place, yeah.
Austin's a great city for that. Right now, they're actually wrapping up South by Southwest Conference, which is like two weeks.
My paper did a big story about the SXSW Conference, South by Southwest. That's what
sex
you choose.
What was that?
SXSW.
Dude, it just sounded like sex.
It's Austin. No. It's about music.
Yeah, okay. And if you like the music, it's a great time to be in Austin. And if you're not big on the music or you don't like the crowds, it's a good weekend to come to California.
Yeah, because you were talking about me going to Austin this weekend and kind of follow up my earlier trip there, which we're going to postpone until
April
at some point. Because the tickets were like $1,400 for me to go that way just to Austin because of this big music festival.
For real?
Right.
Yeah. So we decided, I don't need to spend that kind of money.
Oh, you cheapskate.
So Renee said she'd come out here. She wanted to meet Sarah. So she came out and she brought her friend Annette with her. And Annette's in here with us.
Hi, Annette.
She's waving.
We got a silent wave.
She's waving.
It's all good.
But I told part of Annette's story when I got back from Austin, if you remember. We talked about someone that had been in the gay lifestyle. For
Renee's.
Yeah.
That's what I meant, Renee. Did I not say Renee?
I said Annette.
You just outed Annette. What's the deal with
Annette doesn't need to be outed. That's not her issue. That's not her issue. That's all different Renee. But I told a little bit of Renee's story. There you go. Sheesh. And... we had a lot of email traffic from parents of kids that have come out in the gay lifestyle and that kind of thing. So we thought it'd be great since you're here, we could have a conversation about. And I'm hesitant to do this, to be honest, because you've got a video online of you doing this, sharing somewhat of your story at the fellowship, a larger fellowship you were part of there for a time in Austin. And I always, a little reticent about somebody being known as ex-gay and finding a big identity there. And I know you don't work at that. You don't want to do that.
Right.
But there's also part of your story that's very encouraging for people that are in the lifestyle or have children that are, or people they love that are. So we thought it'd be fun to talk about it. She also has a lot of resources we're going to post on the website about parents and people struggling with sexual identity and same-sex attraction that was helpful to you. But why don't you just tell us a little bit of your story? That might be a good way to start.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Houston, and I grew up in a Christian home. Parents divorced when I was probably about 8 or 9 years old, and but we attended traditional fellowship there through most of my childhood. I think it wasn't until I was probably about maybe somewhere between 15 and 17 that I started to acknowledge some same-sex attraction, and I think that really shook me up a bit spiritually because I had a pretty strong teaching about homosexuality as a sin, and so I struggled with what to do with those feelings and kind of suppress them until I was about the time of was moving away from college, in which time that freedom of the distance of moving away allowed me to explore that a little bit more, more safely outside of the church, because there was no safety in exploring that with anybody
not so much
at home. No, not in 1988, no. And not necessarily today either, but although there are more safer places, I think I have found more safer places than I had found at that time. So, I got into a relationship at age 18 that I would be in for 10 years. And actually would spend, 20 years, in the gay lifestyle and in two long-term relationships, before I got to that place where, I got back into a Christian fellowship and just little by little became more and more unsettled with that part of my life, and just not at peace and really convicted that it was time to surrender that.
Because why? Because is that from a social dynamic that it didn't fit, or was that an internal thing?
I think I never had a real peace about it. I think I convinced myself that I did because I didn't know how to get out of it. So I think at age 17 or 18, I knew it was wrong, and yet I didn't know how to deal with the feelings that felt intrinsic to me. And I felt that, and I kind of had an attitude towards God at that point that, I'm not going to turn from this or deny myself this if you can't explain to me, like you owe me some explanation as to why is this wrong. And why do I feel this way? And those were questions that I didn't have answers to. And in my anger about that and frustration about that, I just put all that, tabled it all, put it all on the back burner and said, you can't have that part of my life. And so.
But you kind of compartmentalized that to some degree. You still attended church during that time and still felt like you had a relationship with God? Or
I very much compartmentalized it. In order to not, feel a huge amount of shame over it, I basically kind of joined camp with those that I was encountering at college. And I was on a very liberal college campus here in California. And, there were a lot of people that were out and proud. And that was the first time I'd seen, it was in the 90s. People were starting to, gay pride was really getting big. And I thought, well, if I'm going to be open about my sexuality, I need to also embrace it and be proud of it. And yet there was no place for that in the church. So I had one identity in the church and one identity. And I had a lot of people real convinced that I had found a peace, there was a happy medium and that I had found a peace in both places, but truly I had not. They just didn't overlap too much. It was very compartmentalized.
Did you still feel like in terms of your own relationship with God, was there a point of connection there?
For sure. Yeah. I think I continued to grow spiritually. And in fact, that was some of the confusion about it, is that I felt like I was growing deeper in my faith and I was connecting to God and even recognizing his blessings in my life. And so if this is so wrong, why am I not being disciplined? Why is he allowing me to have such a fruitful life? And why am I growing in connection? But there was some separation at some point. I did get tied up, mostly in academics and so forth and the busyness of life, that's more of why I left the church first than not being at peace about the sexuality. It's just that because I wasn't at peace about my sexuality within the church, I didn't really dive into the community of the church. So I attended church and I grew in my faith, but I didn't connect with people.
Kept a safe distance.
Yes. I mean, I was on the edge of the church. You know, I sat on different rows every week that I attended, hoping that nobody would get to know me because I just wanted to hear the lesson and take that home. And I didn't want anybody a part of that side of my life.
And when did that begin to change? When did those two worlds collide, I guess?
Well, they collided when in 2007, I had moved to Austin in 2002, and at that point, I had a five-year-old son. I very much wanted him to be raised in a church, so I went. I'd been out of the church for about 8 years, and I went looking for a church that was an open and a loving church, a church where there was a lot of grace and where he would be comfortable. Where if he disclosed that he had gay parents, or if I disclosed that I was in a lesbian relationship, that people wouldn't turn and run, that we would be welcome. We could be known as who we were. And so I went looking for a church like that, and I found a place that was safe, and I started to grow. And as my relationship got deeper and deeper, my desire for connection there within the church and in community and being involved for people to really truly know me grew. And at some point, you know, after about 5 years or so, I really felt more and more of a conviction that my lifestyle and my choices and my relationship were not compatible with my faith, and it just became a growing discomfort. I mean, I had fallen into a place of just kind of peacefully coexisting with that sin, and it was becoming more and more eating away at me internally, and I had no peace. I really hit a point in my life where I had achieved everything I set out to achieve in my youth in terms of like success, career, family. I was living where I wanted to live. I kind of had all that I set out to achieve, and there was not peace. And I recognized that, and I knew that it was a spiritual thing. So I knew there was something not right between me and God. And I was set out on pretty much a mission to discover what that was.
And so what did you do to begin? What was your kind of next step of how do I deal with the fact that these two worlds are colliding? And I mean, there was a lot of, you talked about kind of, God, why'd you make me this way? There was some anger at God through those years of being engaged. Yeah. How did that come back to him? And how did you reconnect with him in a way that made sense?
Well, I just kept recognizing how much he loved me. And I started growing in his love, I started wanting my life in every way to be honoring to him. And so I started kind of going through the areas of my life and just sort of holding it out to him. You know, am I honoring you with the way I spend my money? Am I honoring you in my relationships and the way I serve in my career and these things? And it was one of those.
By the way, we haven't talked about your career. What do you do for a career?
I'm an OBGYN and in practice in Austin. I work for a large multi-specialty group there.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic career.
Yeah, you deliver babies.
Deliver babies, do surgeries.
Yeah, wow.
Take care of women.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, it's quite a blessing.
Your desire to say, God, am I honoring you? If I were to ask this question in terms of, was that a relational draw or was that an achievement draw? I mean, if you set out all these other things to achieve and you got there, how was that desire to say, God, I want all my life to line up? Some people get on a performance treadmill.
Yeah, I don't think it was about performance. It was a matter of the heart. It was like literally I had a moment. You know, some people have their turning point. For me, it was a moment in my closet in my house in 2007 where I sat in a puddle of my tears in my closet realizing that I had everything, like that my life, I had so much, and yet there was not a core of peace or happiness or contentment. Why was I not content? And I didn't want more of any of the things that I had. I wanted something that I didn't have, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was between me and God. So I just said, if you will show me what that is that I don't have, or what it is from me that you want that I'm not giving you, you can have it. If you'll get rid of this feeling of discontent, and if you'll restore a peace that I had known, say at age 18, 19, when I was, I think really I think that was the last time I remembered having it. Where did that go? If you'll give me that back, you can have anything. And so I basically just gave him the flashlight and said, shine it all my life and show me what it is. Because I truly was so deceived by that that I had actually, even though if you'd asked me, is this a, do you recognize this as a sin? Do you think that this relationship is sinful? I would have said always all my life, yes, I do. But what are you going to do about it? I would say nothing. But here I was giving God permission to show me what he wanted to change. I was opening myself up because I had to get out of that feeling, that state. I was kind of desperate.
At this point, does anybody in the fellowship that you're going to know that you're having this struggle with same sex? You kept that pretty hidden.
No, I had kept that to myself.
So what did you do? Did you begin to open up to others? Did you go to some ministries that were helpful to you in dealing with?
I truly didn't open up to anybody until I'd already made the decision. It was very personal between me and God. I didn't let anybody in on that. There were people in my life that I could have let into it beforehand. I mean, there were those safe people. But I didn't until I felt like he was telling me. And what happened is I was becoming more and more dissatisfied also in my relationship. My relationship was starting to fall apart. I was wanting more and more God time, more and more alone time with him. I was hungry for Christian community, for Christian service. And my partner wasn't meeting me in those places. And I was realizing that this path I was headed on, she really wasn't headed on with me. So I just thought my relationship was falling apart. Mm. And then when I recognized that I saw God's clear hand leading me out of that relationship, he gave me a really clear sign that it was time to bring that to an end. Then all of a sudden I recognized that he was asking something much greater for me. He was really asking me to close that whole chapter of the book and to repent of the sin and move out of the relationship and out of the, I hate to say the lifestyle, but really just to close that chapter of my life and to go back, to honor him with my body and to move towards purity. And, that was a really, really, that was probably the scariest thing, I had ever, recognized that God was calling me to do.
Yeah. I was just thinking 20 years down a path that you've decided to just say, okay, you know, guess what? I'm compartmentalizing this. I'm going to let everything else go on like it's fine, but we have supernatural powers of compartmentalization and rationalization as human beings, I think.
And the compartmentalization wasn't like I wasn't in the closet or hidden or anything like that. It was compartmentalized in my mind, right. But it wasn't I was completely transparent in all environments. So it wasn't that I hid any part of my life from anybody else. I just I didn't go deep with people because I didn't want to be called out on that.
Sure.
You know?
I just think it's most people, when they spend that much time in a direction, do find it really hard to change course.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? I mean, I know there's a transaction that's happening with God, but there's also the mechanics of walking that out that just as human beings, we don't tend to let that happen very often.
Yeah. Well, it was frightful. It was really frightful. I've told a lot of people it felt like I was literally placing my whole body up on an altar and offering that to him. It really felt like true death. I mean, a whole part of me was dying, and it was 20 years. I mean, so much of your identity is formed between from 17 to age 37. That was who I had been all my adult years, and so it was a huge change. Yeah.
We also talked when you were asked a bit about your mom looking in on this part of your life. I mean, you felt like you had incredible love from your mom, even though her value structure, moral structure would have been different than what you were living. Can you talk about that relationship a little bit, what it meant to you, just the way she interacted with you through that 20-year period?
Yeah, I didn't appreciate it at the time. I appreciate it now, really how just how loving she was without ever compromising her values and what was truth to her. So, I mean, it was very difficult to come out to my mother, especially because we were quite close. And at age 17, to tell her that I've fallen in love with a woman and I see myself moving towards a relationship that's going to be a long one. And I knew it wasn't going to be with her blessing. And it was very hard for her to receive that news. And it would take her some time to settle into that. I mean, she grieved the receiving of that news. And I was confident in my choice and and she couldn't change my mind. So there was nothing she was going to say that was going to convince me otherwise. But she spoke out and told me that she knew this was sin, and that she didn't imagine she was ever going to change her mind about that, no matter what I did. But she would love me without condition. And she told me that. And she then demonstrated that over a very long time. No mom knows when a child tells them that, how long are they going to be on this path? Is this just a phase they're going through? Is this something that they're going to, a couple months later, that relationship's going to end and they're going to go back to, either.
After 10 or 20 years, you don't think it's a phase.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Well, even there's a lot of choices along that road, because you're talking about, you and your first partner had a child together.
Right.
That would have been a struggle for your mom, I would think.
Right.
But did she celebrate that child as a grandchild? I mean, was she able to, is that some of the way she expressed that love, even though, gosh, this wouldn't be my mom's choice? She's still in here loving us in the midst of it.
Yeah, and even before that, I mean, she demonstrated her love in just showing an interest in all the things that I was doing, that never changed. She didn't separate herself or have some lesser degree of communication with me. I mean, I was away in California in college. She came to visit as often as she would have otherwise. She got to know my partner. She got to know the friends, my community. She didn't ever detach herself from my life in any way. She still continued to support me in every way that a mom would support a daughter, financially and emotionally and all those things. So I knew that she loved me and respected me as a person. So, and she treated everybody with such respect that I don't think that any of my friends even would have ever thought she had any objection to the lifestyle or to, because she just seemed to be just at peace with that. But that's, if they would have asked her, she'd have also been very honest about where she was not. But yeah, when we had a kid, I think there was probably an adjustment for her that was difficult. This is not how she imagined having a grandchild. And yet she embraced him and loved him and was a very active and involved, has always been in his life, loving grandparent. But, there's some choices that you might make along the way. I mean, I never went so far as to have a gay union or marriage or seek that out. But there were some times when my partner and I would celebrate, and this would be in my next relationship. When that one ended, I was in another behind it that would last 6 years. And, we exchanged rings personally, just the two of us, and showed our commitment towards each other. And some friends threw us a party. And I remember inviting mom to that party. And I remember she came, but I could sense her discomfort being there. Like, does this mean that I condone the relationship? What is it saying, my presence here? She never had to speak that out per se. I remember being thankful she was there, but also real aware that she wasn't completely at peace about that.
So you didn't need her to agree with you to feel her love for you?
No. I didn't, but I may be a little unique in that, Wayne, in that I didn't even need a church to agree with that, to love, to feel comfortable in a church. And that was not true for my partners. So the two partners that I had would feel quite uncomfortable in a church where they knew that they would speak out as that this is a sin, even though it may not come up but once every 6 months or even every 2 or 3 years from the pulpit. If the church spoke out against homosexuality, I had partners who weren't comfortable with that, and I'd always only ever known that, and so I had a peace about that. I mean, because the truth was, I knew it to be sin. So
I think you are pretty unique there, because it seems on the other side of that lifestyle, so much of people reaching out, wanting to talk, you're bad. It's like there's almost a desire to have a theological argument that they want to prove to me, no, this is fine.
Right.
And it is such a gulf where you're going like, no, I do think you can have a wonderful relationship with God. I think all of us compartmentalize our sin.
Yeah.
I think we have our wonderful scale of how we want to say, well, those are the bad ones and those are the okay ones. The ones that are mine are the okay ones.
Right. Well, this didn't fall in the category of the respectable sins.
No, it didn't.
Yeah.
But it's interesting for you to be in a place where it's like, no, I know it's wrong. And most people are almost vehement of a need to have it justified. And that's where it's like, golly, that's where so much of the communication is really broken down, because it's like, well, I don't know how to, I can't justify that. I can't jump to that conclusion. But I got friends that are gay, and it's like, you know, yeah, we can love them, we can be kind to them, and I'm not having a fight all the time with them on, you know, truth issues. It's more like, well, you know, no.
Well, that's where this sin is really different, because it's not because it be, so many people see it not just as the as a sin, but as their identity. I mean, it's right. And it, I mean, there's a whole movement behind legitimizing it. You know, what other sin has a movement behind it like that? So, and I was in a unique place. I don't think that most gay Christians are where I was, acknowledging that it's sin and just deciding not to turn from it for 20 years. I think many more, depending on where they come to faith along that time, but many more buy into gay theology and then they get sucked up into that. That was never my journey. I was never convinced by any of that. I mean, I would look at the scripture and then I would look at all the arguments against these six verses, each one having their own arguments, reasons why these were not valid. And you had to put them all together to buy into gay theology. And I could never do that. I could maybe look at one or two but then all six of them together, it was like, really, I'm going to work that far to validate this choice. I couldn't do it. It never logicked out to me. There would have been more peace in it had I been able to do that. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of my friends would, and even my partner, at one point, you know, kind of embraced that thought. And then, so she was much more relaxed in that relationship than I ever was.
How old is your son?
Son's going to be 14 in 2 weeks.
What's this journey been? I mean, he's not here to speak for himself, but what's that journey been for him? Gosh, I mean, that's just a mind bender.
Yeah, that's real tricky. It's real tricky. It's tricky because I co-parent with my ex, his other mother, and she's we've been apart for many years now, and she's in a 9-year relationship that followed up our relationship. So she's with another woman. So he's part time in her home. He's part time in my home. So it is tricky because, you know, it's a relatively recent thing. Almost 3 years ago that I you know, acknowledged that this was a sin that I was going to turn from. And, you know, that's been relatively recent. So he was like 10, 11 years old. So now you've got to explain that to a young kid. Well, it was tricky. You know, he tried to explain it as best as he can understand it at that point. This is something that, God has put on my heart, a part of my life that I had once embraced that I'm no longer at peace about. And I think, I've, you know, you put it in 11-year-old language, but basically to try to teach him that, you know, that I'm surrendering this part of myself to him. And I feel like this is the right decision to make. And it's a decision that's between me and God. It's not for me to tell other people what to do. So, you know, because I needed to make sure that he would be, you know, I didn't want him to be unsettled with the reality that there's many other people in his life, including his other parent, who are in the lifestyle, who don't see it as sin, you know. And it's hard. It's hard not to confuse
a
child.
It's a tricky one.
It's very tricky. I'm still working on how is the best way.
You don't want to alienate from the other mother.
Right.
You don't want to be dishonest about the theology behind it.
I don't want to be truthful about what I'm going through so he can understand it, but at the same point, not appear to be judgmental towards so many of the people in his life, towards all gays and lesbians, you know, and acknowledge the fact that many of the gays and lesbians in his life or that he's going to encounter aren't even Christians, so they may never wrestle with this in the same way that I have. So, and that ultimately everybody has to decide for themselves, you know, what is right, what is wrong, what is sin, what is not, and make those choices. And he too has to decide for himself. So,
The turning from sin part, you talk about, you know, like a sacrifice on an altar, just giving God back your body. How did that walk out in the next little season? Was that just a grit my teeth and conform myself to what I believe was biblically right? Was it God changing your heart in ways so the attractions changed over time? So it's been 4 years, I guess, if it was 2007.
Well, it's been almost three since I actually made the decision that I was going to leave behind the lifestyle and move towards sexual purity, honor him with my body. So it was you know, it was very difficult, and it's gone through lots of different seasons. I mean, there have been some seasons that have been harder than others. I'm not in a difficult season right now, but the first year and a half was especially hard because I had to just redefine who I was. I had to totally see myself, my identity, in a fresh new way, outside of that part of me, and I had to place myself in safe environments. I lost some friendships, gained some many new friendships. I felt like I started looking for places where I could find healing. Not like a weekend seminar or a single conversation, but something that would happen over a period of time. And I found a healing ministry that I got involved in for about 6 months. And that really helped me kind of journey through that.
Was that like a live-in situation, or were you still part of your life? This was Bible studies and encouragement kind of on the side.
No, this was a ministry of Desert Stream Ministries. They have a branch called Living Waters. And Living Waters is a six-month curriculum that you do. It's one night a week, 3 hours, a lot of daily reading. And meeting together in a large group setting, and then followed by some small group where you really share and you journey through, you know, what are the reasons why we're sexually broken, and what does it look like to move toward wholeness, not only in the area of homosexuality, but whatever your struggle is, whether it's, you know, promiscuity or a history of abuse or self-esteem issues or any of a number of types of relational brokenness. You know, how do you journey out of those? What does it look like to take that struggle to the cross? And what does it look like to lean into community in accountability and confession and support to move beyond that? What does it look like to find freedom? And what is freedom? You know, I had to discover that I thought, I mean, I had to be convinced that this life was true freedom, that the old life I had was in fact not free, but chains and bondage. And that took some work. It took a lot of work.
So did it feel more like a grit your teeth, I've got to do what's right? Or was there more heart stuff in it? Or can you give us a feel for what it felt like? Was it sometimes like grit your teeth and other times you're relaxing into a reality? Or
sometimes it was. Sometimes it's, you know, for a long time, it felt like I made this vow in 2008 when I made this decision. I marked it with baptism. I had been in the church all my life, but I'd never had a water baptism. And that's a long story, but why I had not. But finally, I found a community that was open and embracing that I felt a part of. And I wanted to mark that. So I marked that decision on the day of my baptism. And when I vowed that, I realized it was the first vow I'd ever made to God, to that I would honor him in this and walk in purity. And there have been times when the promise of that felt so, oh my gosh, how am I going to stay obedient to this at all costs? You know, what is, and that was real frightening. And it felt like, you know, grit my teeth. I've got to just do it because I promised and I can't break that promise. And then there were other times when it felt, it was definitely much more of a heart thing. I mean, I was feeling my heart was changing. My desire to be obedient to God didn't feel like I was just being obedient to a rule, but more that I was just learning how to trust that he knew better what was good for me, and that what he had for me had my best interest in mind, and that it was all out of love. And then it didn't feel like...
That's a little more powerful than a rule.
Yes.
It's profoundly powerful.
Yes.
So what would you say to someone today that is where you were 3 or 4 years ago, and just, you know, what feels trapped in it, feels like it is their identity, feels like, you know, God gave me this attraction or affection? What do you say to encourage people? Because the stories seem to be incredibly rare of people who, quote unquote, get out of the lifestyle. In fact, a lot of behavioral scientists say until someone's been out of it for 10 years, they don't even say that they're healed yet, because so many even make it 5, 6, 7, 8 years out and then slip back in at some point. How do you see all that?
Yeah, I think it definitely takes some time, because you really do have to unpack. So, I mean, and maybe it depends on how long you were in, that lifestyle before, you know, how long it takes to get out of it. So if you're only in it for a little bit and it's experimental, then it may not be so hard. But if it's become the core of who you are and you've built these relationships, it may take a bit longer. It depends on how much wounds there are to go sort through. So I don't know. I think,
do you know others that have been on a similar journey as yours, finding increasing freedom to walk away from that kind of life?
I do. And I'm encountering more and more people. I didn't really know anybody when I made this decision, and I felt really desperate to find some people. I remember being in that place thinking, I just need to talk to somebody who knows what I feel. I mean, it felt like so alone, like talking to somebody at the church, if they hadn't been in that situation, was not going to really satisfy. Like, I needed to know that there really was a potential for true healing. I'd heard stories of it. I'd read things, but I didn't know anybody. Like, I needed to look at somebody. So, I mean, I went looking for that healing ministry. I was desperate to find somebody who was on the other side and to see them and get to know them and ask them, how did you do that? Because it seemed like an impossible task. And is it for real? I was such skeptical. I mean, so many gays and lesbians hear these stories, or they hear about groups like Exodus and things like that, and they're very skeptical. Well, you can't change me. I can't believe these groups think they can really change you. But it's not the group. It's God that's changing you. It's not the ministry per se. It's just God's just reshaping things. And
that what you just said is huge, because I think sometimes those environments honestly simply become almost more pickup environments for some people who are trying to get out. Desert Stream was a part of one of the churches that we had, and so I'm pretty familiar with a lot of those dynamics. I think when you recognize it's God who's doing something inside, it's a different transformation process. You may have to grit your teeth sometimes, but if you think that there's something deeper that's happening there, it isn't. I mean, I think it's wonderful to have people around, but I mean, I can't imagine how alone you must have felt when you first said, well, I'm making this choice.
Yeah.
That's got to be huge.
Yeah, it's really frightening. You do feel like you're alone. And I kept trying to find my story in books. I'd pick up books, and I never really found my exact story, and that would be frustrating. I just think, yeah, it's hard to know. I think, as God just does a work, it becomes a little bit easier. I think for me, it started to get to where I had to, more and more, he was just changing my heart and making those attractions become diminished to some degree. I was just starting to feel just kind of more of a piece of just of the timeline, not feeling like a rush to get to the other side, but just saying, I'm okay as long as just take this day by day. And I don't know how long it's going to take for these feelings to go away, or if they're ever going to go away. I figured I'd probably go to my grave still feeling this intense desire to relate to women in a sexual way and looking for that kind of relationship. And just over time, I felt that all of a sudden just falling off of me. And then I started talking to God about that. And then he started talking to me and revealing to me that he was taking that away, you know, that he was doing a healing work, a deeper healing work, that it wasn't about me following some recipe. It was just gradually he was working that in me, into where all of a sudden, I guess it's now been about 6 months ago, I just one day realized that I'm not really struggling in this way. For a while, it was a really intense struggle. I remember just standing at my door to go outside of my home, and just fearing going outside of my house, as if that was just a scary place to be, because all of the temptation was there. And what if I couldn't overcome that temptation? And just being just kind of afraid. And suddenly I realized that I wasn't afraid anymore. I had a confidence that he would move me through. So, yeah, I think, I don't know, Wayne, I think getting, you know, I think it's really important to speak out the struggle and not to, I mean, I did a lot of it on my own, but I think that moving into a community, if you can find those safe people that offer love and grace, the quicker you can get into that environment, the easier it is. It took me a long time to realize that this sin was no different than any other sin. I thought this was going to be some exceptional kind of sin struggle that nobody else could understand if that wasn't their specific struggle. And having having been now a few years down that road, I realized that it really isn't. I mean, the path out of it is really not any different than any other. It has addictive type properties. So I think I had to look at it as like, okay, this is kind of like an addiction. It goes deeper than maybe struggling with, I don't know, gossip or something, some other sin, but it's because it is like kind of that core identity thing. Yeah. But struggling with, you know, alcohol or pornography or definitely any other sexual struggle, you got to take it as seriously as you might take an addiction. And yet, any person who really understands God's heart and understands repentance and confession and healing. We can help one another out of that. It doesn't have to be somebody who's had that same exact journey, you know.
What's happened in the realm of that sense of identity, or how you have that sense of definition of who Renee is? I do think that a lot of the sexual sin stuff goes so deep to that sense of identity.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, it's really hard to slice that apart. That's why it is so hard to see change there. I'm just kind of curious to go, what, if anything, is God doing in that sense of, you know, if I was to say, who is Renee? How do you define that sense of self?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had to figure out what was the true self. You know, there's a lot of false identities that I've claimed, and many of us claim many different false identities as we're growing. I mean, and we think that our identity is the things we do or the people we're with, or our role as a parent, or our, you know, for me, it would be a physician. And none of those are really as important as my true identity in Christ. So letting go of the lesbian identity was like letting go of all of the other ones that really don't say who I am. They're not at my core. So, you know, the line I heard that really resonated with me, I heard John Ortberg at a conference when speaking. He said, I am one in whom Christ dwells and in whom he delights. And I heard that and I thought, that's what I want. I want that to be my primary identity and everything else to be a secondary identity. I didn't want lesbian or former lesbian to be any part of my identity. I wanted to move beyond all of those. So some people kind of get stuck in that place too of like, you know, there's Renee, you know, ex-gay. And I'm like, well, but I don't, that's not even my true identity. Right. It is a true statement, but that's not who I am. I'm so much more than that. And I don't want to get stuck in that place. I want, you know, the real freedom of not holding on to any of those things as my core identity.
You being a former pastor.
Yeah.
Yeah. She told me that once.
Well, it's hard to shed those.
Yeah, the religious ones, they're
it's hard to shed those, but people impose those on you. I don't even think I ever really wanted the identity of lesbian. It's just that people classify you in certain ways. I think people put that on me. I don't even think, you know, I don't even think I really.
Yeah, our culture does not have any sense of identity that's rooted in being. It's all in doing. And so it's like my behaviors define me, my occupation, my achievements, whatever that is. Pretty much without thinking, we have that put on us and we embrace it. And then it's like, well, who are you apart from that? Well, there's your identity crisis that happens in our culture, left, right, and center. And how do I deal with change that's thrust upon me? That for a lot of people is so hard because they're not, I am someone in whom Christ dwells and he delights in. I mean, that is not, it's a nice statement for mm-hmm. most people. They go, oh yeah, that's nice. But is that who they wake up and go, that's me?
Well, yeah. We mostly need a label to know how to treat someone instead of just treating people like people and each unique. And we all have struggles. We all have things that we're dealing with as God's setting us free. And there's ways to love each other without having to put it in a box of some kind. I think even the old box of what church mm-hmm. do you go to, the old question that was asked was, so if you're a Vineyard or you're a Calvary Chapel, you're a Methodist or you're a Calvinist, I know something about you that I can begin to treat you with instead of just knowing you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that person be greater. And I know the work I've done in Bridge Builders and the whole sexual orientation issues that I've dealt with a lot in terms of the political aspect of that. Again, where you make your sexuality your public identity, gee, I don't know why anybody would want to do that. Whether you're heterosexual or homosexual or anything, that's not really who you are. It may be a part of your life and makeup, but it's not your life.
No.
And we're people and we're individuals that God loves and wants to set free. And what I love about your story is how relational it is, how real it is, that there's 20 years of you going through some stuff in conflict internally. Your mom's got conflicts going on, but there's still love in the midst of all that. And then there's the ability to sit down and with God and just say, you know, I can't live this way anymore, and I need you to come here, and I'm willing to yield myself to you. And I love all the bits of that. I think they're important processes and how God finds freedom in us. And, you know, some people would freak out, 20 years, oh my gosh, 20 years of doing the wrong thing, and, you know, panicked by that and said, no, life is a journey, and God unpacking us from places we got stuck or got lost in, it's just, it takes time. It is a process. And sometimes even the process of wanting to be free is part of the process.
Yeah.
And then finding that freedom is another one. So
would you say that your mom communicated acceptance? It sounded like she never condoned the conclusion of the lifestyle.
She never communicated acceptance of the sin, right, or of the relationship, but of me always.
See, I think that to me was the exciting thing to hear, that you're just going like, it seems like for so many people, salvation is defined by, well, I know the right things, I believe the right things, and then I try to do the right things. And where that equation falls apart when someone says, well, I'm not doing the right thing. Then we go, well, then you can't be believing the right thing. And it's like, so we nullify just about everything else about that person. Like, how could you be a gay Christian? That's an oxymoron. It's not, you can't be. And you're just going like, well, I know a bunch of Christian alcoholics. And that shouldn't work either. And I think the real dynamic is, well, no, I can be a lover and a believer in Christ, and I'm trying to say, God, here's my life. But, you know, it's got problems left, right, and center. To be able to accept the genuineness of someone that says, you know what, I am going to love you.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds to me like that was the power that had some real force of saying, you know what, my mom she loved me, supported me like any mom would a daughter. That's huge.
Yeah.
I think love is all the more powerful when you know it comes from someone who doesn't agree with you. You expect rejection. You expect distance. When love comes, love really isn't attached to agreement. We think it is, and religion often plays that out. We love what we agree with. Jesus had the ability to love what he didn't condone. And I love where we're learning to live in that space. You can love what you don't condone. And when someone knows I disagree with them, but love them anyway and serve them in some way, I think love has all that much more meaning. It's not diminished by the fact that it's
powerful then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure she got some criticism. I think it was really tricky trying to figure out, okay, so, you know, how much is too much love, or what acts of kindness or respect are appropriate, and which ones are not, you know, which ones are sending.
That ceremony that you had.
Yeah, and it wasn't a ceremony. It was just a kind of a celebration, party. But yeah, a little party thereafter. But yeah, I think that was a real crossroad for her. I didn't realize it so much at the time. She would later tell me, you know, deciding whether or not to even be there was really hard for me. Now I have a lot of I've come across a lot of parents of gays now, even just within my own church, and they'll often come up to me and tell me, you know, I'm kind of struggling with my son or my daughter, and I don't know if I should do this or that. And those who err on the side of love always seem to win in the end. And those who end on the side of I think I won't participate in this because, I mean, obviously, but I think when you don't know, the better thing to do is just be present, you know, as opposed to being absent and then having to.
Well, that just communicates such judgment and rejection, even if that is not necessarily what's in that person's heart. So oftentimes there is that. People need belonging before they've defined what they believe. And wherever they find belonging, it seems to have a powerful shaping force on their beliefs.
Yeah.
I mean, it does.
And not see presence as condoning. I think that's where religious people get stuck. My presence is condoning. Not necessarily.
Right.
If you're condoning, you're condoning. If you're not, you're not. So your presence isn't the determining factor.
Right.
We're way over time. So
okay.
I don't know how much more, Renee, you
But it was
say.
Really good.
It was great to have you come. And Sarah and I are enjoying having both you and Annette out here visiting us and for the weekend.
It's been a good time.
That's kind of fun. And is there any more you want to say? More you got to add to this mess? Any hope you'd want to give to folks struggling?
Yeah, I just say, I say really just to be be patient and really to be prayerful. I really think that you can't overemphasize that. I think that that my mom was a warrior in prayer during those years. I mean, I think that she never gave up or gave up hope, and she invited, as her comfort grew, invited others, other women into that with her in prayer, you know? And so I think sometimes parents just feel like they don't know what to do, and so they don't do anything. And I think you can give up after 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, and just persevere in prayer, because the conviction to change doesn't come from any of the words you're going to say to your child. That conviction comes from the Spirit. And so it's not anybody's words of wisdom or anybody taking me to those relevant passages that got me to shift internally. And only the Spirit can do that. I think just recognizing that and just loving somebody and loving them until they've come to that place. God has brought them to that place, and not rushing that process because of your discomfort.
That's great. Longest podcast ever, but good.
But this was good. I like it.
Great. Thanks for sharing, Renee.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com. Thank you.